Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're not just, reading the manual. We're actually cracking open the architecture that gets built from those, from those brutal debugging sessions in distributed robotics. This is where those weird intermittent failures finally start to make sense. We've got a whole stack of sources in front of us. So logs, code snippets, postmortems, all from high-stakes ROS2 and DDS environments. Our mission today is to pull out three fundamental truths, one about concurrency, one on configuration scope, and one on system safety. These are the things that really separate production code from a proof of concept. So we're looking at, first, that confusing relationship between Python's threading, thread, and ROS2 executors. Then, the really strict per-process limits of OS.environ. And finally, a single, really stubborn limitation in FastDDS that forced a complete rethink of a critical system bridge.
Right, and it's so easy to get lost in just the APIs. But when you build these complex systems, so you just have to understand what the API is actually doing, sometimes down at the C++ level. I mean, these are the lessons that move you beyond writing code that just works sometimes to writing code that's genuinely robust, predictable.
Moving from the surface level to deep mechanics.
Exactly.
Okay, let's jump right into that first one, something that trips up, I think, every developer new to ROS2 and Python, the concurrency conundrum. You see code using a standard Python thread to run a single-threaded executor. And that just sounds redundant, right? Like, taking two cars to drive one person, why do you need both?
That confusion is completely justified.
Yeah.
It really comes down to misleading names. We're talking about two entirely separate layers of abstraction here. They have completely different jobs.
Okay, so break that down. What's the thread doing?
The Python threading thread, that's your concurrency mechanism. Its only job is to control where the code runs. We put the SpinRows method inside its own thread so that the main application thread, your UI, your web server, whatever your main logic is, doesn't just lock up while it waits for ROS2 events.
So it's a container to prevent blocking.
That's it. It's just resource management from the OS perspective.
Okay, so if the thread is handling the where, the OS part, what is the executor actually doing inside that thread?
The executor is the ROS2 event loop. It controls the how. The executor is the thing that's constantly polling the underlying DDS layer, looking for incoming messages, timer callbacks, service requests. And when it finds an event, the executor is the mechanism that actually dispatches that event to your callback function.
So a single-threaded executor doesn't mean it runs in one thread. It means that within whatever thread it's placed, it processes its callbacks one at a time, sequentially.
Precisely. To maintain predictable ordering, if you forget to run the executor's spin loop, your node is basically deaf. It'll be active, but it won't receive a single message because the dispatcher isn't running.
That makes the separation so much clearer. But what about the multi-threaded executor? This is where people assume, okay, now I get free parallelism, but you're saying that's not quite right either.
Not at all. That's another big misconception. The multi-threaded executor just gives you a pool of threads for dispatching callbacks. But the critical piece, the real constraint, is the callback group.
The callback group.
Yeah. By default, every callback you create gets put into a mutually exclusive callback group.
Which means.
It means what it sounds like. It prevents any of its callbacks from running in parallel, period. It doesn't matter if your executor has 100 threads, they will run one at a time.
So to get real concurrency, you have to do something else.
You have to explicitly assign your callbacks to a reentrant callback group. That's the lever you have to pull to get simultaneous processing.
And that whole pattern separating the concurrency mechanism from the event loop, that feels like a universal concept in systems programming, doesn't it?
It is. You see it everywhere. Python's own Ascensio, JavaScript web workers, game engines. Separating how you manage parallelism from how you manage event ordering is just fundamental to avoiding deadlocks and race conditions.
Okay, that clears up concurrency. Let's pivot to configuration scope. We're always using Python's OS.environ to set things up for ROS2. What are we actually manipulating when we touch that object?
OS.environ is it's a super useful mapping object. It's basically a Python dictionary that represents the current processes of environment variables, a key value store for your running program.
And we use os.getnv, or the dictionary get method, to read them safely, right? So we can give a default and not have the program crash if a key is missing.
Yeah, and you always have to remember that the values are always strings. That's a classic bug right there. Forgetting to convert a port number to an integer or flag to a Boolean. But the crucial architectural limitation, the one that will send you on a week-long debugging chase,
Oh, gotcha.
is that environment variables are strictly, and I mean strictly, per process.
Okay, what does that mean in practice?
When your Python script changes OS.environ, You are only changing the configuration for that one running process. The changes are totally isolated. They vanish the moment your script exits. And crucially, they have zero effect on any other running process on your system. Not the parent shell, not another node, nothing.
So if I have node A running in one terminal and I launch node B in another terminal but change raw's domain in its script, node A is completely unaffected.
Completely. And this matters for everything. ARM implementation, your domain ID, and critically for our next point, the FastProTPS default profiles file.
That leads us right into the cautionary tale, the big DDS configuration mistake. The goal was to have two nodes in the same Python process connect to two totally different DDS discovery servers. And the attempt was to, you know, change the environment variable and then create a second urkelpy.context. Why was that doomed to fail?
Ah, yes. The moment we learned about process global C plus singletons. That one. That cost us a lot of time.
I remember the hair pulling.
So here's why it fails. Specifically with TurkleFastTPS. FastDDS is built on these singletons at the process level. The FastTurkleSPF profile forecodes file environment variable. It's read by the XML profile manager exactly once per process.
Once.
The very first time the DDS infrastructure gets initialized, which is usually triggered by your first urkelpy.in call, the profiles are loaded, cached in memory, and that's it.
So even if our Python code correctly updates our shell s.environ to point to a new XML file for that second context, the C++ layer underneath doesn't care.
It completely ignores it. The RNW layer uses a Proctus global participant factory. Mm. When you create a second urkelpy.context, you're just attaching to the existing, already configured DDS infrastructure. You don't trigger a reload or a rewire. It's a done deal.
So the architectural implication here is profound.
It is. It means one Python OS process cannot host nodes that need fundamentally different DDS configurations. You're trying to run two isolated network stacks inside a process that only allows one. It just can't work.
Which means the working solution had nothing to do with clever context management?
Not at all. The working architecture was dictated entirely by that low-level caching behavior. It had to be two separate OS processes.
Each with its own memory space, its own environment.
Its own initial load of the FastTurkleTPS default profiles file, and its own completely independent DDS stack.
And to get the data between these two now isolated worlds, you couldn't use DDS. You had to bridge them somehow.
Right. We used a standard Python multiprocessing.queue. We just bypassed DDS for that specific interprocess link. It's a great example of how a low-level constraint forces your high-level architecture.
Okay, this leads us perfectly into our last point, moving from isolation to system reliability, the HDAS node crash. This was a fail-deadly situation.
A classic case. You have input corruption that leads to a catastrophic system failure. We had a faulty write gripper. It just started sending out-of-range, malformed sensor values, just garbage data.
And the HDAS node? The hardware abstraction and data acquisition node, which is the critical link between hardware and ROS2, it didn't handle the garbage. It just crashed.
Right. And the impact is an immediate loss of safety. HDS goes down. The control system loses its vital signs. No more sensor feedback.
The robot is blind. And any further motion is completely unsafe.
Exactly. And diagnosing this is tricky. Because it's a background service.
You have to go digging for the logs.
You have to attach to its screen or tetmux session to see the exception. And here's the kicker. Because bad sensor data can sometimes corrupt the state of the hardware itself, a simple software restart often isn't enough.
You have to do a full power cycle.
Often, yes. Mm-hmm. A full power cycle of the robot to get back to a known good state.
This just screams the need for layered fault tolerance, something that's so easy to skip when you're moving fast.
You absolutely need at least three layers of safety.
Okay, what are they?
First, input validation at the source. The driver that's reading the gripper data needs to validate and clamp those values before they ever get published. Contain the garbage at the entry point.
Layer two.
Graceful degradation. The HDAS node itself must have comprehensive error handling. Try accept blocks everywhere. It needs to catch bad data, publish an error status to the system, go into a safe mode, but it absolutely must not crash.
And the final layer, the last line of defense.
Health monitoring. The high-level control system has to be actively monitoring a heartbeat from critical nodes like HDAS. If that heartbeat stops for even a second, it has to assume the worst and enter a safe state. Stop all motion immediately.
So tying it all together, it seems like reliable system design is this balance between understanding the low-level rules of process isolation threads, environment variables, DDS singletons, and building robust fail-safe architecture on top. We've covered the separation between concurrency and event loops, the strict per-process nature of configuration, and that rigid DDS caching that forced a multi-processing queue bridge. And finally, why layered fault tolerance is non-negotiable.
Yeah, and these are the insights you only get from system failures. They're the things that teach you when you have to abandon a high-level API and drop down to an OS-level primitive, like a separate process, because the abstraction just can't give you the isolation you need.
So the final thought for you, our listener, to take away from this deep dive, don't just trust the abstraction layer. If an API like UrkelPy.context seems to promise isolation, you have to ask the next question. Is the underlying component, the DDS implementation, the C++ manager, is it truly isolated? Or is it relying on a process global singleton?
Because that assumption right there is where the deepest learning and the most painful debugging always happens.
To dig deeper, we definitely recommend looking at the FastDDS XML configuration docs, the ROS2 executor documentation, and really mastering Python's multiprocessing library.
It's essential for understanding true process-level isolation.
We'll catch you next time for the next deep dive.